How about a side of crickets with that burger? Might sound uninviting here in the United States, but eating insects is common to cultures in many parts of the world. Good morning. I'm George Polarki, and this is Cityscape on 90.7 FM and WFUV.org. Coming up, we'll delve deeper into the idea of insect eating and its potential benefits for the planet. This morning's show is all about bugs. Glad you're with us. Our first guest became interested in bugs as a child. His interest was so deep, he went on to make a career out of studying insects.
My name is Lewis Sorkin. I'm an entomologist, an arachnologist at the American Museum of Natural History. And I work on mainly the spider collections, the preserved spider collections, and myriad pod collections.
What does that work involve?
Well, the spider material has been collected from around the world, either by people here or other collectors from around the world, and send material in, and it's in a collected jars and vials, so it's miscellaneous spiders and other arachnids for the most part. And I have to sort through the material and identify at least to order or family of what all these creatures are, so then they can be used later on by a researcher who's working on a particular family of spiders, let's say.
Are you being sent live spiders, or are they all dead by the time they get to you?
Oh, no, they're dead in alcohol, because arachnids are preserved in alcohol.
What was the rarest spider that's come across your desk?
Oh, wow, that's kind of hard to say. There's some kind of rare families, of which there's only one species known for the family. So that was a halid spider. I saw a few specimens of it. You know, I sorted out for the material. And there's been some bug families I sorted out, the pelaridiids that are known from Australia and down in South America. So they're not seen by very many people because they're really living in leaf litter. So if you don't collect in leaf litter in those countries, you wouldn't find them and see them at all.
How long have you been interested in bugs? You're here 38 years, but how long have you been interested in bugs?
Oh, actually, I think that goes back to when I was a child, and I used to collect spiders and insects, especially insects, because those were pinned when you keep them in a collection, and an easier thing to sort of curate. And I'd collect live bees and beetles and wasps and butterflies. And early on, I think my uncle went and ordered, you know, a spreading board and material from, I think it was Ward Scientific, many, many years ago, in the 1960s, I'd say. And from there on, I just really enjoyed looking at insects and spiders, especially through magnifying glass or now through microscope.
To what do you attribute that interest? Often people are very afraid of bugs, but you are drawn to them.
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, I was also drawn to snakes and turtles, frogs, you know, the things people usually don't like, not furry, not hairy.
And you have to feed them bugs, too, don't you?
Yeah, some of those you feed, or sometimes they'll eat mice, you know, and things, but usually they were insectivorous. And the spiders, I sort of got into, and actually spiders, mites, and ticks I got into more when I was at the university, because no one there really worked on any of those creatures, so I figured I'd do that.
Where did you go to school?
That was at University of Connecticut at Storrs.
So did you come here straight from college?
Yeah, I had 2 weeks off.
That was it, 2 weeks off.
Sat here, and that was it. Right.
What would you say is the most fascinating thing about what you do here?
Well, spider-wise, or specimen-wise, it's actually seeing what occurs in various countries that you normally don't see. You know, you can see foods in a country and see maybe trees, plants, and people. But if you don't get down into leaf litter, which most people don't, and you see the microscopic fauna that's living there, that can be very different from one country or one hemisphere to another. That's what's kind of very interesting.
How familiar are you with the bugs right here in New York City?
I'm sort of familiar with a lot of the local creatures you find, a lot of spiders more than a lot of the insects, but also some of the more common insects. And by being here so long, I get a lot of calls from people. Mostly it's about problems in their house or in their home and wonder what these things are that are invading their property. So I get to know a lot of the common pests that are here too.
Such as what? What are the most common pests?
The more common, originally when I started here, roaches. There were German roaches, American roaches, and now more brown-banded roaches seem to have taken over where the German roaches would be in the home. They're about the same size, too. And then in the last 20 years, bed bugs have been a pretty popular or unpopular topic.
I want to talk with you more about bed bugs, but let's talk about roaches for a moment. How does a new breed of roach come on the scene in New York City?
Well, sometimes they're not brand new, except they're just at low populations because another species sort of outcompetes them. And for some reason, the brown bandits have been much more commonly encountered now in New York City, at least. It may be that they're more adapted to dry areas, too, more than, like the Americans like sewer systems, basements, and moist places. The German ones are usually in the home, but for some reason, a lot of offices would always have brown-banded roaches. They didn't care much for the water as much, but they would just be in boxes, they'll be in file cabinets, and some other reasons, they were, I guess, brought in by people, you know, who had them in other areas, maybe in other homes or other places, and they sort of took over some of the counts and some of the apartment buildings.
The initial instinct of most people when they have a roach in their home is to squash it quickly.
Yes,
should we
right.
be that fearful of roaches to get rid of them when they get in our homes?
Yes and no. There are many bacteria that can be transferred by cockroaches because of where they will live. If you look at the American roaches, a lot are in sewer systems, so they pick up a lot of bacteria in their gut and on their body, so that can be transferred. Similarly to houseflies, which feed on all kinds of feces and droppings and food, human food, and then transfer that bacteria, let's say, from the droppings to a food item. And it doesn't bother them, but of course it would have an effect on you. But instead of really squishing them right away, a lot of the bait systems for roaches work really well. So if you kill it, the bait doesn't really do much anything anymore. So it's better to let them take the baits and bring it back to harborage areas where there are more roaches, because a lot of the horizontal transfer occurs between shed skins and roaches, because they will feed on shed skins, and they'll pick up on droppings from other roaches, and that way they're transferring the insecticide to them. So it actually helps to have them alive and not to kill them right away, but give them the bait systems.
Let's get back to bed bugs, of which you are an expert. What do you think would surprise people most about bed bugs? Clearly, we've heard and read a lot about them in recent years.
Gee, it's hard to say. I think a lot of their behavior is quite interesting, and to watch them interact. Of course, it's one thing to have them overpopulating your home and feeding on you, and either causing a really bad skin reaction or bad psychosis because of having bed bugs. There are people, many people actually have no reaction whatsoever, and then they don't realize they even have a problem in their home. Many of the people I speak to, or of course when they come in, I show them live ones because I keep them in vials here, and then people, once they see them, then they either have the thought, and they say, well, I didn't know they're so big, or I didn't know they're so small, because they actually have the wrong idea of what they're really looking for without seeing live insects to base their search image on.
Bed bugs right now aren't making headlines like they were a few years ago. Is that because
That's
the media
correct.
Just tired of it, or because it's less of a problem?
It's still a big problem, and the media, I think, is tired of it. It's not there aren't brand new stories anymore, so it isn't being picked up as readily as before.
But we still need to be mindful of this.
You still need to be vigilant, mindful, and understand what bed bugs look like, and just know how to search for them, what to look for.
Now, you mentioned that you have bed bugs here in vials in your office.
Yes.
I understand that you allow them to feed on you.
Yeah, that's how I kept them going for about 20 years. I don't react very badly to their bites. So in order to keep the colonies going, I just have them feed on me, and then they're fine.
You not only study bugs, but you eat bugs, Lou. Am I right?
Yeah. The bed bugs feed on me, and I feed on bugs. Yeah, I have a lot of different insects and that have been eaten by people and are eaten by people around the world. And I try to rear a few of those. Crickets are especially easy to rear. And there are now a lot of companies that produce chips and cookies and flour made with crickets, like one or two species of crickets, and either pure cricket flour or mixed with another type of flour to change the flavor of it or extend the amount of flour that you wouldn't have to use so much in a cricket. This seems to be pretty expensive, I think, up to like $40 a pound.
Really? $40 a pound? Wow.
Yeah, so if it's mixed with other flours, it's not as expensive.
I would also think, of course, for a lot of people, more palatable to eat crickets as a cookie than just crickets on their own as crickets.
The cookies don't hop. With the crickets, we've found out in at least the U.S. and Canada that if the crickets are ground up into a flour, you don't see the insect anymore. People readily eat breads and cookies and chips and things like that made of crickets.
Right. What is your favorite bug to eat?
I actually like crickets. And there's also a waxworm as a caterpillar, tomato or tobacco hornworms. It's a very large caterpillar, and you can raise those. And I've done that, cooked them, dehydrated them. And I'm planning on trying to make that into a flour to see how that would work.
Do you eat bugs on a regular basis or just for special occasions?
Special occasions and a semi-regular basis, you know, at least with the chips, they're called chirps, appropriately. And I bring them around to people to see how they like them. So it's not a bad thing to try.
All right, Lou, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, you're welcome.
Lou Sorkin is an entomologist at the American Museum of Natural History. He's also the treasurer of the New York Entomological Society. If Sorkin's taste for bugs has inspired you to try some for yourself, you might want to pick up a copy of the Eat a Bug Cookbook. David George Gordon is the author. He joins us on the phone this morning. David, thanks for taking the time.
Good to be talking to you.
So when did you first start cooking with insects?
You know, I actually wrote my Eat a Bug Cookbook in 1998. So, yeah, almost about 20 years now. Started with things like crickets, and then moved my way all up through tarantula spiders.
What inspired you to start cooking with insects?
You know, in 97, when I was researching the book, there was not, shows like Bizarre Foods were not on TV yet. So most of the information was really in things like anthropology journals. You know, I like to write about weird science, and I was actually doing research on cockroaches. I kept coming across places where people eat cockroaches as food or use them as medicine, and that really opened my eyes. Of course, I started asking, why don't we eat bugs? And that's really what led to the book.
So how much of the world outside of the United States utilize bugs as a food source?
Yeah, you know, surprisingly, I've read statistics that say that 80% of the world's cultures eat bugs. That information, by the way, comes from the UN. They say that 1.9 billion people eat insects. And we're kind of the oddballs in that 20% who don't.
Why do you think that is? Yeah, why do you think that is, David?
You know, I've never seen anything concrete about this, but I suspect a lot of it has to do with our own investment in agriculture. You know, as farmers, insects are the only animals on the planet who are in direct competition for our food. So, of course, the idea of eating them is like admitting you're sleeping with the enemy. There's some benefit from them. And I think we have evolved into this kind of nation of bug bashers. We think bugs are germy and disgusting and gross, none of which is true. But you know, our own culture seems to have an unusual dislike for them.
How do you overcome the intimidation of eating bugs if you are someone who is skittish of them?
Well, you know, first of all, it's entirely mind over matter. We eat all sorts of weird stuff ourselves. And I actually joke about, you know, chicken eggs are about as weird as you can get. We're talking about eating the chickens, period, basically. So, first of all, it's mind over matter. Second of all, I think because we do eat with our eyes, you know, we like to look at the food as well, that things like concealing the bugs in, a covering of chocolate or tempura batter, like I like to do, is a good way to friendly yourself up into the idea.
What are among your favorite recipes?
Oh, gosh, you know, my Eat a Bug cookbook has 40 of them. I kind of like them all. But I do like the deep-fried tarantula spiders, which, if prepared properly are surprisingly good. I like grasshopper kebabs. I really like anything with the waxworms in it. Waxworms are actually the little white caterpillars of a moth that lays its eggs on the honeycomb of a beehive. So when the eggs hatch, the caterpillars are basically eating beeswax and honey for the rest of their life.
Where do you find bugs to cook with? Because they are not in my local supermarket.
Oh, but they will be soon. You know, there are actually several companies now that are producing, for example, organically raised crickets for human consumption. When I started writing the book, a lot of it was mostly by either going to a pet store and buying live food for your bearded dragon or your iguana. You know, you can buy crickets and mealworms at a mm-hmm. pet store. But now there are places all over the Internet. There's actually a lot of stuff being imported from Thailand right now. And if you go online, I'm sure you'll find a whole host of edible insects.
Why do you think it is that they will eventually be in local supermarkets?
You know, the UN came out with this report 2 years ago, and they were saying in that report that the way our population of the planet is growing, that we're going to add a whole other billion people in the next 40 years. That we couldn't possibly feed all those people hamburgers, even if we wanted to. It just does not pencil out. So that they're actually urging in this report for people to start raising and eating more insects.
As you said, though, it will take some mindset changing.
I think so, in our own culture especially, because like I said, we have a really bad attitude about bugs. It's ironic because, of course, if all the insects were to suddenly vanish, our planet would come to a screeching halt in about 2 weeks, I think. They provide so many different functions. So we need to change our attitude. It's really for the health of our planet.
Can you eat household bugs, cockroaches that are crawling in our kitchens?
You know, I'd be a little wary about that, mostly because of pesticides, not because of the bugs themselves. But if the bugs in your garden or under your refrigerator or what have you are eating pesticides that we've put out to kill them, then you eat those bugs. Now you're eating the poison yourself. It's a little bit like Hamlet in the poisoned wine chalice.
What are the health benefits of eating bugs?
You know, bugs are incredibly rich in things like, well, protein, for starters. Pound for pound, they say dried grasshoppers and lean ground beef are equivalent. That's pretty amazing. But also you're getting things like vitamins, calcium, zinc, iron, and the other surprising one is most insects have omega-3 fatty acids. Those are antioxidants that you usually only get from things like eating salmon. Of course, they'd be much less expensive than eating a wild-caught salmon.
You mentioned chocolate, you mentioned tempura, but what other seasonings go best with bugs?
I try to season my dishes lightly. I want people to be able to taste the bugs, not the seasoning. I like to use the example. I talk to people who say they went to a French restaurant and ordered escargot, snails, and then I say, what does it taste like? They say, well, it tasted like garlic butter. You know, basically the seasoning has overpowered the ingredient. So lightly seasoned, sort of following the rules of seafood, because a lot of bugs have a very mild seafood-like flavor to them. I have a whole section in my Eat a Bug cookbook on pairings, wine pairings with bugs.
So what wine goes best with what bug?
Oh, you know, I like a crisp Chardonnay or a Semillon Blanc for most bugs.
So we always hear the funny saying, it tastes just like chicken. Do any bugs taste like chicken?
And I always ask myself, what does a chicken taste like? It's so hard to really compare things. You know, a tarantula basically tastes like a tarantula. On the other hand, I would also say that a tarantula tastes kind of like when it's prepared, like soft shell crab. Or actually, I was doing programs in New Mexico this past weekend. They were saying it tastes like fried okra.
David, thanks so much for your time.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
David George Gordon is the author of the Eat a Bug Cookbook. He's online at davidgeorgegordon.com.
Everybody's got a love bug deep inside. Everybody's got a love bug for their own.
Next on Cityscape, we're shifting from eating bugs to looking at what bugs eat, specifically ants in New York City. Clint Pennock is a researcher at North Carolina State University. Pennock studied the diet of ants in the Big Apple and determined they have a taste for people food. Clint, thanks for joining us.
Ah, thank you for your interest.
So what inspired you to study what New York City ants are eating?
Well, when we think about cities, we usually think about buildings and concrete and the people that live in them. But if you look around, there's actually a lot of animal species that are living in cities as well, and not just, you know, people's pets, but also pigeons and rodents and what I'm most interested in, which is ants. And so one of our questions is, has been, you know, what allows these animals to live in the population size they do in the middle of some of the most urban areas?
I would imagine that there are a lot of people out there saying, really, ants in New York City? I wouldn't even think about that.
Yeah, definitely. So we get a lot of we've got a lot of surprise about our interest in ants to some degree, especially from the people who grant us permits to work in the parks. Pretty much every time we go to work, we work mostly, one of our major sites is along Broadway, on the Broadway malls, which are just traffic islands that run up the street. Yeah, and it's been interesting. It's sort of a Byzantine group of people who run this strip of medians, and it seems like every five medians we have a different park authority official or police officer who's interested in our permits, and we're like, oh, well, we're here, you know, studying ants, and that always gets an eyebrow raise.
I'm raising my eyebrow right now over the fact that you need a permit to actually go study ants on the streets of New York City.
Oh, yeah. You need not just, you know, one permit, but probably more than that. We've been hauled into some city offices and, you know, in our sweaty clothes working in the street to meet with people sitting, you know, in very nice, clean business suits. And we kind of have to explain to them what we're doing and that we're scientists and that we have PhDs and this is a real thing. And yeah, so it can be a little tricky working in cities sometimes.
So what's actually involved with the research?
So for this project, basically, I went up to New York alone for about a week or so. And what we're interested in comparing is the diets of ants that are living in parks, which are more similar to natural habitats and forests outside the city, and then compare that to species that are living really closely right alongside people in New York, so species that are living in these Broadway malls, as well as species living directly on the sidewalk on Broadway. So basically what I did was go out. I went through all the major parks in Manhattan and then up and down Broadway and collecting ants on the malls and on the sidewalks and take them back to the lab. And what we were interested in looking at was the stable isotope content of their bodies.
What? The what who? Huh?
Yeah. And so stable isotopes, we looked at carbon and nitrogen, which are two of the major elements that make up all animal bodies. This is a classical tool used to study nutrition in animal populations that's largely been used only in really natural ecosystems. So it's been used in tropical rainforests, deserts, pretty much everywhere, but no one had ever really been using this in cities like the size of Manhattan. So what you can do is we collect ants, and then we measure the carbon content and the nitrogen content of their bodies, and there's a particular signature in them that can tell us whether a species is feeding more as an herbivore or as a carnivore, and that comes from the nitrogen isotope side. But the side that we were really interested in was carbon isotopes. And so the ratio of heavy carbon to light carbon in an organism can tell you something about the base of their food web. So if they're feeding primarily on grasses, like something living in a prairie, or if they're feeding on non-grasses, like forest species. So what was interesting to us about this, there had been some studies that showed that the standard American fast food diet has a really strong stable isotope signature of grasses. And this comes from the corn that is in our foods as well as the sugar cane. So if you think about the standard North American fast food meal, you have a hamburger that's made from corn-fed beef. You have a soda that's sweetened with corn syrup. And, you know, in some studies even found that they fry French fries in corn oil. And so even when you look at stable isotopes in humans living in North America, you can see a difference based on their hair samples than you can, for instance, from someone living in Europe or Asia. And so we were really wondering if we could use this tool instead of looking at humans, but to look at ants that live right next to us.
So what did you find out about what the ants in New York City are eating?
No surprise, ants are eating our garbage. But what's interesting is that not every single species that we find is, and not to the same degree. So we focus mainly on this species called the pavement ant. And it's probably the most common ant living in New York, But it's also common in cities across the world. So they live in, it's the most common ant in Chicago, it's the most common ant in Boston, they're found in San Francisco, and even in Europe and Asia. So this is a species that's been following humans around the world, and it's kind of a specialist at living in our cities. And so we predicted that out of all the species living in New York, that the pavement ant would be the one that's eating our food the most. And so that's exactly what we found. It turns out, based on the stable isotopes inside pavement ants, they actually are starting to look more like humans in terms of what they're eating than the ants that we find normally in parks.
How many species of ants are there in New York City?
I think people will probably be surprised to hear this, but there are over 40 species of ants living in New York City that we've found.
40 species?
40, yeah, and most of them you're going to find in parks. So we'll go and we'll break open rotten logs, we'll roll over little rocks and look for colonies, but only a small subset of those species is commonly found in the city, closer to humans, in sort of these traffic islands on Broadway and on the sidewalks. So we find more or less a core of about 5 species that live in really close contact with humans. And these are what we think of as urban specialists. And that was one of our big ideas, is that what allows these species to live in cities is that they might just be better at eating human foods and our garbage than the ones that are living in the parks.
So are ants that eat junk food in any way susceptible to human illnesses associated with a poor diet, like diabetes or obesity?
Yeah, I think that's one of the first questions we get about this. You know, what happens when ants start eating Big Macs? Do they start having heart attacks and cholesterol problems and everything else? And right now we think, no, they don't. It seems like, especially for pavement ants, when human foods are available, that's when they do the best. So their colonies get to the biggest size. They seem to be the most active. But, you know, there could be subtle things going on.
So ultimately, what do you think we can glean from a study like this? What's the takeaway?
One thing to take away is that we don't often think of ourselves as key components of ecosystems. But, you know, in fact, humans and people living in cities are actually the major driving force in allowing these other animals to live there. And so our actions have consequences for both the abundance of other animals that live in our cities and probably the types of species that live in our cities. I think one way to look at this is it might be a bad thing that we're contributing to explosions of rats or pigeons or ants or anything else that people tend to not like. But some other work in our lab suggests that ants could be performing a very important service for us. So in a study where Elsa Youngstat, another postdoc working with us, left out common human foods on Broadway, she left out hot dogs and cookies and potato chips, she found that ants, you know, overnight were actually consuming a pretty significant amount of these foods. And if you multiply this out, the ants living just on Broadway were consuming over 2,000 pounds of human foods a year. And so in some ways, we were able to kind of target that the pavement ant and some other species like them are the species that are basically helping us clean up our cities. And so for every bit of food that a pavement ant eats, that means there's less food for rats. Which
they should get a paycheck from the sanitation department, is what you're saying.
Yeah, they should, right? Yeah, they should be deputized for the sanitation department, the pavement ant. And so, yeah, it seems like they could actually be contributing to the health of our cities and cleaning up our garbage before it sort of festers and molds.
All right, Clint, we'll look out for you on the streets of New York City with your ant collector.
All right. Thank you, George.
Was a bug, little bug, hardly there.
That was Clint Pennock. He's a researcher at North Carolina State University. And that's it for this week's Cityscape. Remember, you can listen to past editions of Cityscape at any time on demand at wfuv.org/cityscape or download our podcast on iTunes. I'm George Bodarchy. My thanks to producers Taylor Nolk and Claire Drake. Have a great weekend.
It's WFUV and WFUV HD, New York. Listener-supported public media from Fordham, the Jesuit University of New York. Music discovery starts here.